Hello and welcome to Conversations with Benjamin Boyce. Today's conversant is Maya of Maya Muses, which is a YouTube channel that's been up and running for a year, year and a half, thereabouts. Maya is a Los Angeles resident, a history and sociology major, but principally a comedian and somebody's interested in comedy. But with the goings on over the course of the last 16 months or so, she kind of realized that what is comedy to do when life is so ridiculous in and of itself? I stumbled across her channel when she made mention of me on YouTube, having done a video on me, and I poked into her stuff. I'm like, wow, this girl does not have enough attention on her, on this platform at least. I don't know if she wants more attention when she walks to get her latte, whatever it is she drinks. I think they drink bubble tea down there, if she's of that generation. Anyhow, this conversation, we talk about her worldview and how she navigated life up to the very present moment. And I actually quite like her a lot, and hopefully I can have her on for some live shenanigans. Let me know what you think about her opinion and our rapport, but most of all, just sit back, relax, and enjoy the show with myself and Maya of Maya Muses. So you're a production professional then, huh?
Yeah, I came out here to do production. And so we do that. We do comedy, YouTube videos. Yeah, it's all about sarcasm, which I'm sure you've picked up on.
I like your content quite a lot.
Do you have any videos specifically that you watched? Well,
you did one about me.
I did that one about you. I made a few jokes.
Which I appreciate.
All right.
Yeah.
And then, recently I've been on a mass hysteria kick. It's just been...
Okay. Wait. Are you like joining throngs of the mass hysterical, or are you commenting on the mass hysterias?
I'm deeply concerned about the numerous mass hysterias that seem to be going on at once right now. They're just feeding off each other and deeply, deeply concerned.
Huh. Why would you be concerned?
Well, right now we're coming up on Halloween time, which means it's witch hunt season. We watched The Crucible last night, and I see that people are losing sense of themselves, and they are starting to act in ways that are illogical. And if you go throughout history, you just find that a lot of times this ends up with people hanging. And I don't think it's going to end up with people hanging right now, but you know, there are metaphorical hangings like we saw during the Satanic Panic of the 80s, and I don't want to see people lose it. I actually love my country and I love its people, and I would hate to see us embarrass ourselves.
Okay. And if people, as you say, are losing themselves, then they're assumably, you think that people can know themselves or have themselves or find themselves or possess themselves. What's the counterpoint to losing oneself? What's the core like values and structures of being self-possessed in your viewpoint?
Well, this is actually funny because I had a conversation with my neighbor the other day, and it was the most basic learning English 101 conversation. It was, "Hello, Robert. Hello, Maya. Okay, how are you today? I am good. Wonderful. I hope you have a great day. Okay." It was a very shallow conversation. Mm-hmm. It was, I know me and my neighbor don't get along with everything, you know, but he's still my neighbor. And even if there's stuff going on in the world, you can have that superficial conversation.
Okay.
Just pleasantries, just chit-chatting with the lady who, at the cashier, you know. I feel that those are things that we have to do, maybe daily even. Just so that we remember, okay, we're in a society, there are certain ways that you must act in a society, even if it doesn't seem authentic all the time. Who cares? Nobody cares what you think is authentic or not. Say hello, say goodbye, wish them well, and go on about your day. So act right in public. That's what I mean when I say losing yourself.
Okay, so human connection then would be the first basis of being self-possessed.
Yes, I mean, there's a human connection, but there's also, you have to acknowledge, at least in America, I know not every country does small talk, but in the United States, we do small talk.
Okay.
And that small talk is basically like us saying, okay, we don't necessarily come from the same tribe, but I'm going to smile at you so that you know I don't want to hurt you. Mm. And I'm going to wave so you see I don't have a weapon in my hand and that we are polite. The British, you know, they're very good about it. You know, they're just like stiff upper lip. This is the way you act. Mm. And I feel growing up that there was a certain way you acted. And the adults knew that. There was a sort of decorum. Like everybody got that. And now I feel maybe it's because of lockdown. We had a very bad lockdown, a very intense lockdown, where a lot of people did not leave the house.
You're speaking of a particular city in the United States that is the bedlam of much creativity and a particular ideology, correct?
Yes, I'm in Los Angeles.
Okay.
I'm in Los Angeles, and I like Los Angeles. I really do. The quality of life in Los Angeles is like nothing you could imagine when it's working out. So when I say that, I mean any food you want, any type of cuisine that you want, anything you want to do. Like if you want to ski and then you want to skate and then you want to go to the beach, all in one day, you can do that in Los Angeles.
Barring traffic,
you just have to figure out the right times of the day to do this. You can do anything. And then if you want to get your liquor in a grocery store, you can do that. And if on the way home from the grocery store, if you want to pick up your weed, you can do that as well. There is every type of community. There's every type of thing to do here. And that shifted dramatically last March, where then we had a very strict lockdown. And things started to get a little bit Mad Max-y. That's what people say.
How did it feel to you? Like, could you describe the shift in feelings beginning, I guess, previous to March? There's probably some rising fear about the reason for the lockdown. And then it changed with the lockdown. So could you just speak to the soul of LA over the past 19 months or however long it's been?
Well, I love Los Angeles, but I'm an optimistic person. I'm hopelessly optimistic. So I love Los Angeles. Huh. And I love America, and I love people and all these things. And people get on my case. My readers or my viewers get on my case, and they're like, how can you be so optimistic? And I just am. That's my personality type. So it's going to go into wherever I am. Even though you see from my videos, they're very dark.
Yeah. Well,
super dark.
We could probably broach that a little bit later, but that's just how do you create content. You can't just like talk about unicorns all the time and baby poop. You have to get into the actual fecal matter of life and then do your little sunshine bits, you know, right? Kind of drifting through the wafting of the darkness, maybe.
I mean, you got to be real about it, but just because you're being honest, it doesn't mean you can lie. You know, you have to say this is what's really happening and this is my take on it, and how could we possibly dig ourselves out of this, or how can we live our best lives despite the fact that we are in the middle of a Mad Max sort of hellscape right now? Not hellscape, but my goodness. So we started covering coronavirus because I used to produce this show called Daddy Issues with Tony Baker and Keon Poli, and now it has these other comedians on as well. So I used to produce that show I've been doing that for years, but starting in January and December, actually, there was talk of COVID coming from the East. And I was the person, I'm always on what's going on. Like I was telling them, this is what's coming. And the general idea starting in January was that it was just a flu. It's not going to come here. It's not going to bother us. So I said, well, have you been looking at this? Have you been looking at that? And so it's so funny because if you watch Daddy Issues from the beginning of January until I left, it is a progression of COVID news. Just like, oh, it's just in China. It's just a flu. It doesn't matter, to, okay, now we're locking down, or we're not going to lock down. you see the shelves are crazy, they're empty, and people are like, this is all comedy. So I'm the person who, I have a comedic heart, but I'm also like, well, this is the world. I laugh at the world because I had a, you know, I've been through things which allow me to laugh at the world the way it is. You know, people look at me and they're like, oh my God, you're so young. You know, you look so bright-eyed. Why are you so miserable? And I'm like, I'm not. I'm just seeing it the way it is. And it's still funny to me. So we didn't get, it was basically like a week where it was, we're not going to lock down. To not only are we going to lock down, we're going to have one of the strictest lockdowns in the country. So that was a very, very fast shift. And I didn't think that was fair because I was warning our viewers, you know, make sure you stock up. I was warning my friends, make sure you get at least another week of food. You know, things are going to get really weird. But they were telling us that they weren't going to get weird. They were telling us, don't worry, you know, don't mask, don't do anything. And it's just like, well, you've lied to these people. And now the day before we locked down, now the shelves are empty. They're empty.
How long was the period between the declaration of lockdown and lockdown? Was there like 48 hours, 72, 3 days, a week, 2 days?
I want to say it was less than a week because we got, and I have to go back and look at the timeline, but we got the word that other places were locking down and they said that would not happen here. They kept saying it wouldn't happen here. It can't happen in America, all these other things. And then when they wrote up what the actual lockdown would be, Target stayed open. These big box stores stayed open, but a lot of smaller places, they either had to close or they were given a technical loophole to stay open or there was no more foot traffic for them. So they were effectively closed anyway.
Yep.
And I know a lot of people, including my landlord, who his shop closed down. And it was really hard to watch that happen to him because he was a hard worker. He works every single day. He's a good man. And he's been fair with us with rents, which is one of the major things in Los Angeles, is you can't get a landlord who's going to be fair to you with rents. And he's such a good man. And so to watch them take away his shop, it was really gut-wrenching to see something like that. Mm-hmm. But Target stayed open. And they let the entertainment industry stay open, which for us was fantastic. It worked out well for us. Because we were able to find a way around things and we were able to still thrive. And we had to get very creative. We started this thing called Keep Your Distance.
Is that like some sort of juggling maneuver, troop thing?
Yeah, it was a comedy night. So it was a live comedy and basically people bought their tickets and it would live stream. And so that was with the Kev on Stage crew. And, you know, we made friends real quick because we were like, okay, they're closing down all of our business, all of the jobs that we had lined up to, you know, so that we could pay rent through the year. That's all gone. There's no travel. That stopped abruptly. And then it was, well, are we going to get unemployment? Are we going to get this? Are we going to get that? And that was really hard. I personally was not able to get unemployment. I think I was too honest on my application or I erred on the side of honesty and they rejected my unemployment completely. Mm-hmm. My partner was able to get unemployment for the bare minimum because the way it works is that you take jobs in the industry, you take jobs. You don't have like a career, like a few people or some, but who we're dealing with, you don't work for like Disney, you know, you take a job here, you take a job there, you take a job there. And so depending on how they gave you your payroll, that would then decide how you would get unemployment. So a lot of people in the industry had only really worked on paper for like 3 days in 2019, when really they had been working constantly. It's just which jobs actually counted toward the unemployment. Mm-hmm. So it was a mad dash for everybody to see, do I qualify for unemployment? A lot of people were just like, let me work. Just let me work because I'll take the risk. I would prefer to take the risk than lose everything. And when you're in that, you know, 25 to 35, 25 to 40 age bracket, this is when we're building what we're going to have for the rest of our lives. So for them to say, oh, you can't work right now, and then are you going to be able to dig yourself out of this hole? Because they gave us this eviction moratorium, but you still owe all the rent. I guess for psychopaths, we're like the sociopaths or whatever. Well, they can get around it. But for people like us, we're like, well, we're going to have to pay rent at some point. Yeah. We're not going to leave these people high and dry. So it was just, I don't know how they made all of these rules. But when you go back and you look at the actual lockdown from the city and then comes from the state, you look at all these loopholes and it's just like, oh, you took care of your friends real well, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You took care of your friends and the people who gave you money. But for everybody else who, you know, especially those people who were just getting off the ground, like we were just getting off the ground. 2019 just was the year where we could say we're making some headway. It wasn't all for nothing. Okay, let's keep this going. And then they came and said, it's all gone. And so luckily, we were able to pair up with Kev On Stage and do Keep Your Distance, which was a comedy show that we did every 2 weeks for about 6 months. And that was great because a lot of those comedians, they couldn't work either. Mm-hmm. And for comedians, they have gigs. It's the same thing with like, you know, someone who works as a grip for from job to job to job, yeah. Or lighting or, you know, sound. They get paid by the comedy club per gig. So they're just kaput. All their income is kaput. So we were able to bring them in. People from all over the country were able to watch this live comedy show. It was fantastic.
Was there, did you notice any adaptations from stage to screen for these comedians? Was there a learning curve for that? Or do you think that for the most part, the comedy translated well into a virtual audience as opposed to working a room or whatever you guys do?
Well, we were able to have an audience, and that's just another funny story. It was outdoors.
Audience. Oh,
it
cool.
was live. We had to have a certain amount of people, and we had to test everybody who came through the door. And of course, that cost a lot of money. Now, when this first happened, I had a friend who works in production. He was smart. He was able to get like boxes of the antigen tests so that they could keep going. And when he got the antigen tests, he was like, they're $5, $10. And by the time we realized what we were doing, those were no longer for sale, which is a huge gripe of mine because why are the antigen tests not for sale if you don't want people to catch COVID? Anyway, so we hired a company to come in and give everybody in the crowd, every comedian, everybody the tests. And it cost us over $100 per person.
Jeez.
It costs a lot of money. That was one of the major expenses. Jeez. Was just testing the crowd.
Oh, wow. But you guys were able to, you guys were able to balance that with virtual tickets then, kind of subsidize
yes.
that. Yeah. Okay.
We were able to sell enough tickets and there was a cutoff point. It's like, if we sell less tickets than this and doesn't make up for bringing the comedians in, paying the comedians, and we did pay the comedians, testing the people in the crowd and all of these things. And we were able to make it work, but it was almost a miracle that worked out. And a lot of crazy things had to happen. A lot of coincidences had to happen for us to be able to do that. But we were able to stay open. We were able to keep the business afloat. We were able to employ people who were out of work because they were working in film and it closed down. And we're able to keep comedians coming in and working. And it was just like, yes.
Wow.
Yes, we did it.
So this is the summer. This is the summer over the summer of 2020 then? Or
this was over the summer of 2020. Yeah. Last year was absolutely mad here. It was madness. There were curfews and we were worried, are they going to close down? Are they going to close us down because of the curfews? Literally, okay. 6 p.m. some days, the alert would go off on the phone and you have to go. You have to go home. You have to be home.
Do you know what they're based on? Just some sort of weird calculation that they do?
The
halls of justice.
Protests, the riots/protests.
Oh, so they did. They stamped down on those protests in Los Angeles. In Portland, it was a complete gangbusters, all or nothing. Seattle, they even like gifted them land for some period of time. I don't know if you probably heard about the Chaz or the Chop. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that was a disaster. But we learned.
You guys didn't have that in LA then.
We had some serious protests that ended up with police confronting the protesters. I don't think we ceded territory, although Melrose, The Melrose District. Have you heard about that?
I remember there was this blonde girl on a TV show called Melrose Place back when TV was a thing, back in my youth. Before your time.
Oh, no. Well, didn't they remake that?
Spinoff of 90210. Well, I'm sure they've Hollywood doesn't have endless amounts of ideas. That's what the gig economy is for. You guys are the ones who come up with the new things. Hollywood just kind of rehashes big things. Noise. I don't. That's how I see it. But maybe you can defend them.
Oh, I can't. They completely ignore us. And you'd think with what we're bringing them and the followers we have with the people we're bringing them, we just don't know the right people.
That's a good thing. Maybe they would sell your soul or do something.
I think it's probably for the best. Honestly, I irrationally believe that everything is for the best. I know it's irrational, but it helps me. So, but yeah, last year there were many days where we were under curfew. And there was one in this district called Melrose, which is the Fairfax District, and that's in West Hollywood. And I believe, when I say we ceded that territory, we ceded the territory to chaos, because that used to be an upscale area. And now there are muggings and murders there frequently. And when you think that people are paying, you know, $2,500 for a one-bedroom, two-bedroom apartment, and they can't go and have lunch on the street without someone strong-arm robbering them, which happened. If you check out KTLA, you see this. That Fairfax district, that was ceded. They just ceded that territory. And a lot of businesses closed down, which also with the shoplifting businesses closed.
Yeah, isn't there? Well, I heard I think it was San Francisco, but maybe it's just California-wide. Like, it's not a crime to steal anything under $6,000 or some stupid thing, right? It's like
$950. Dumb. It's so dumb. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money to most people.
Yeah.
$950. And oh my God. So they can go in stores and fill up shopping bags.
Yeah. Because it's $950 per item, right? Not total. You can do like a whole bunch of $950 items, or is it like $950 and it tops? And are there cops out there total. like looking like those Walmart people, like looking through your receipt but like checking the bag and doing okay, you're good, you're fine.
Well, it's $950 total. And so they'll come in and they'll say, well, I've stolen $900, and that's a misdemeanor. And then they let out the prisons. It got crazy. And I'm like, what happened? What are you doing?
What are they doing?
I don't know. It's them trying to be kind, but it's also, they're bad elements. They think that all poor people are criminals.
Okay.
Or these criminals are just the impoverished. And it's like, no, poor people aren't doing this. These are drug addicts. These are criminals. Impoverished people are, you know, they have a taco stand. They're selling flowers on the side of the road. They're still trying to make a living.
They're
still trying to make an honest living. And I think it's because our leaders are so high and mighty that they're like, well, we should be kind to poor people. And it's like, what are you talking about? We're not this. I grew up impoverished. I'm not ashamed to admit it, but like, these are drug addicts. These are not impoverished people. They just don't understand. They're too far away.
You know, they're like acting like Robin Hood, but they're the robber barons. You know, they're stealing from the middle class and giving to the poor, you know, while they like amass massive amounts of wealth by all these investments in these companies that they pay off, that pay them off. It's so corrupt. It's terrible.
I can't believe they get away with it. I really can't believe they get away with it because all these businesses have shut down, but you know, Target's thriving, Amazon is thriving. So these guys can go and try to go to the moon or whatever they're doing. And it's like, you need to make $140 to live comfortably here. Just especially over the past year, housing prices skyrocketed, food, gas, everything skyrocketed. So really what would be upper class in the rest of the country is middle class here. And they're saying that these people, the middle class, are the enemies. And it's like, these people are just trying to go to work.
Weird. So weird. So you guys adapted, those glorious just as full riots happened. That's a lot of material. So as a creator, as a content creator, what did you find most salient? I mean, we'll work up to mass hysteria, but I mean, I guess the whole thing is mass hysteria. What about that mass hysteria really got your creative juices going?
It's absurd. It's so absurd. I'm like, I can't do comedy now. I can't. So I stopped and I have the YouTube channel and I just cover it honestly. And it's comedic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it gets a little dark, but
yeah, well, it's a dark time. May we live in interesting times is a curse and it's come true for our moment. Why did you get into comedy though? Production, drama, all this stuff. How did your life lead you into this, product-based thing?
I'm smartass.
You're a smartass. Okay, yeah. So you're in the corner popping off during math class and geometry.
No, I paid attention.
Oh.
I love math. I love learning. I read a stupid amount all the time. Okay. I just find reality to be hilarious.
Okay.
And so I started my college career majoring in journalism. And then I was advised that if you're an honest person and you are going to be a good journalist, don't go into journalism.
Can you repeat that for the folks at home? Why would they say that? What's the reasoning there?
You can't be honest. You have to have a tribe.
Huh.
You can't be objective. If I were to be a journalist, I would be fired from every possible outlet because there's a video on my page that makes everybody mad. Yeah. Nobody is happy with my videos. Or if you're happy with one, you're not going to be happy with another. And that's something I basically promise you. Nobody is above it. Everybody can get it. That's just the way the world is. Okay. Absurdity is absurdity. And when reality is so different from the truth that what we know, then that's pure comedy. That's comedy gold. So okay. I started to major in journalism at University of Paris, American University of Paris. Had a fantastic journalism professor there who was like, don't go into journalism. He's like, don't go into journalism at all. Huh. And I went back to URI, which is my home school. I very proudly have gotten a public education this
Rhode
whole
Island?
Way. Rhode Island, yes. Okay. Rhode Island. I've gotten a public education this whole way, except for when I have paid for school, they've been the worst schools. So I went to get my bachelor's at University of Rhode Island. After having my fun year at the American University of Paris. And then I started off in journalism. It wasn't academically rigorous. And this is a critique. I know I don't want to offend anybody, but I don't know if journalism needs to be its own major. It might be a minor for other majors.
Okay.
So I said, well, this isn't very rigorous, journalism. So I switched into history, U.S. history. A double major with sociology. So why do people act the way they act is what I wanted to get at.
Okay.
Because I knew I wanted to be a writer of some way, of some kind. And so I need to know what is driving these people, at least to the best of our knowledge. And so I finished out my bachelor's at the University of Rhode Island with those double majors. And then I said, well, I'm going to write. And I had already made a mockumentary while I was in university. And it was just making fun of this whole culture that we had, the reality TV, which had taken over everything. So I say, let me go to LA. I'm gonna try to go to make comedy a career.
Okay.
And I did. And that's how I got out here.
You just landed, feet on the ground, like Axl Rose getting off of the bus in that first Guns N' Roses video. Again, before your time. But you just arrived on the Sunset Strip, dewy-eyed, doe-eyed, whatever. Your eyes are wide. You're ready for action, and then you somehow make it.
Oh, I didn't make it at all. I failed miserably.
Oh, really? Just once?
Yeah. No, I failed many times. Okay, so I got here and my good friend had set me up with an internship at Paramount. So I interned with the guys who made Transformers.
Okay.
And then I learned very quickly, nobody in Hollywood cares about art. Nobody cares about the quality. It doesn't matter. If it's going to make money, it's going to make money. If it's not going to make money. Right. So I learned the business in a studio. This is how it works.
Okay.
This is who you have to suck up to. This is the pipeline of becoming an executive, which is actually quite interesting because mm-hmm. you start being abused at an agency.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. They'll abuse you for a year.
All right.
And you do everything they want. There are some major agencies that you work at as an assistant, and you have to deal with executives and agents who, we're not going to get into the quality of people, but Hollywood does not select for academics. I'll just say that.
Okay. Well, yeah. No,
Or ideologues. It's a business.
Okay. I'm going to put that over there. Okay. Later on, we can get back into that. That's an interesting little point that most people won't really realize. There's probably something really cool there. So go on. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Well, at least when I was interning, it's about money. So yeah. I did my internship, and then I wasn't going to go the corporate route because I mouth off too much. I can't behave myself on social media. Mm-hmm. I'm too honest. Like, even though if I don't realize it, and then I can just say I'm joking, like, oh, I was just kidding, because people laugh at it, but it's like, no, I'm being honest here. I'm just saying what I see. Mm-hmm. And so I was never, ever, ever going to go that corporate route. That would never have worked out for me. Hmm. It would have been a total waste of time. So I did a bunch of gig stuff in production.
Like, back end, what did you specialize in? Like, organizing, producing, doing the grip stuff, getting into cinematography? What did you gravitate toward?
Oh, producing.
Okay.
Producing, make sure everything runs on time, making sure everybody is where they're supposed to be, et cetera. Second AD, AD, that kind of stuff.
Nice.
And so that was actually a lot of fun. But I mean, especially in indie, they will abuse their workers, but not on purpose. It's just like, it's a low budget. And you're young, you got to come out here, you got to cut your teeth, you got to make the sacrifices.
Yeah.
So I'm not complaining about any of that. I'm very grateful for all the work that I found here and all the people who found me work and those relationships that I made on these gig sets, you know, still last to this day and have been some of the most important relationships. So even stuff that I worked on for free, I have to say, well, if I didn't work on this, it wouldn't have led me to that and so forth and so on. It's just this. I came out 10 years ago. I came out to Los Angeles 10 years ago, and I don't know how anybody could come out to Los Angeles now with the rents the way they are. Like, I was able to pay $700 for my room. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I had an old Civic. And so the gas was probably at least $1.50 cheaper than it is right now. It's mm-hmm. it's crawling up to $5 a gallon right now. So, yeah, that's California taxes.
So if you want to work with truth, don't go into journalism. If you want to work in art, don't go into Hollywood.
Go indie.
Go indie. Okay. Why do you care about truth in art?
Because that's what is real. Everything else, I think, is a mirage.
Okay, but how did you realize that that's real? Like, what predisposed you towards truth? In your brain or in your background or something like that? Why did you decide that that was the best policy?
Well, I was raised well.
Oh.
I was raised properly. My mother. Oh. This
I was
going to
ask about
mother.
Her. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Wow. Okay.
So she was a linguistic anthropologist.
What the?
And she was a linguistic anthropologist out of Brown. I grew up around Brown University.
Really?
Yeah. I basically grew up on the Brown University campus.
Okay.
And so she was a linguistic anthropologist, and she had started off in Egyptology. She's brilliant, brilliant woman, like off the charts, brilliant woman, Fulbright scholar,
okay.
Which got taken away when 9/11 happened. Did you see the 9/11 video?
Wait, no, I didn't. Wait, what? They gave it to, they took away from your mother and they gave it to Ibram Kendi? No, that's MacArthur genius grant. I'm sorry. Fulbright scholar is a different thing. Anyways.
Yeah, she was a Fulbright scholar, and she was doing her research in Lahore, Pakistan, and she'd just gotten a Fulbright scholarship, and she was a single mom this whole time. We're like, way to go, Mom. You did it. We're so proud of you. You got the Fulbright scholarship. Now we can live comfortably in Lahore while you finish your research. And then 9/11 happened, and they were like, you guys have to leave Lahore. And we're like, we're not going to leave Lahore. Lahore's fine. We're very difficult people. We're a difficult family. And so they're like, if you don't leave Lahore, we're going to take away your Fulbright. And the thing is, and this is the point I made in my 9/11 video, if we had left Lahore, she would never have finished her research. Because when are we going to go back? It's just going to get worse and worse. Now, I was in Lahore, Pakistan from 2000 to 2002. So I don't know what it is right now. I just know that when we were there, the people were kind, that we were safe. I know that certain American journalists, particularly men, were in danger, and there was things that had happened in Karachi with Daniel Pearl. But in Lahore, which is a more progressive city, you know, and people say all the Muslim world is this, the Muslim world is that, but Lahore, yeah. Pakistan is filled with kind people, well-educated, civilized people. And for some reason, because of all of this hysteria that had gripped the United States that we were not a part of, we were on the outside looking in. So we didn't realize how mad people had gone back home. We were just like, what are you?
Yeah.
It's fine.
Okay.
Yeah. It's cool, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so...
And you guys just stuck it out until she finished her research? Was she just working on a doctorate, I guess? Or what?
Yeah.
Okay.
This was the last thing she had to do to finish her dissertation to finally graduate. And she had gone back to university at age 37 after she had 4 children. And so we were just so proud of her. And she got her doctorate. And it was great. So she raised me. And I mentioned that video that she had a very strict code. And it didn't always work out well for us, but it was, you take the losses so that you don't compromise. And she wasn't even necessarily overly religious, but there was an element of, there's something more going on here. It's not just what you see in front of you. You need to have a code that you live by. And right now I consider it like, oh, I got to keep my conscience clean. There you go. Keep your conscience clean, whether you believe in a soul or not. Okay. But maybe this whole world is a test and you cannot fail it. So she had a code and she lived by that code. And she comes from an academic family as well. She came from an academic family as well. So there was a few generations of art matters, truth matters. This is how you were raised from a small, small child, as early as I can remember. These were the values we were raised with.
Okay.
We used to watch Star Trek. I don't know if you can see that painting.
I see Picard in the background.
The Kennedy pose.
Through the window. Oh, that is a Kennedy pose. Did you make that?
Are
you a painter as well?
No. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. So he's in the Kennedy pose, which means he's disappointed in us because we failed him.
Well, better than this, I guess. I don't see the face palm, but he does look a little disappointed.
Yeah, and it's so funny because she raised us and she's like, this is what the world is going to be like when you get older. It's going to matter that you are well-read and all this. Lies. All of it was lies. Like, which is okay. Because you kind of raised your... Of course, it doesn't...
Be well-read, you think?
Does it matter?
Does it not matter to you? I mean, does it matter for you?
It matters to me, but does it matter in the world? Do people care that...
What you produce seems to benefit from all the stuff that you've pushed into your cranial matter.
And that's true. And there are a few thousand people who ride with me hard. But there are other people, but that's it. And that's fine. And I'm doing it for them. But in the world, who is successful?
Well, not the artists or the truth seekers.
No. I would have been way better off if I had not had my head filled with all of that. But I am.
Interesting.
I mean financially and I mean my lifestyle, but since I'm a generally happy person, I'm like, well, this is hilarious.
Okay.
And when I have a child, I'm going to lie to them too. And I'm going to tell them that truth matters and I'm going to tell them that art matters. And then when they turn 18 and leave the house, I'm going to go, aha!
go forth and bursteth thy bubble upon reality. Yeah. The shoals of, I guess, society rather than reality. You said that you love your country.
I do.
Has that been tested? How has it been tested?
Oh, yeah. Well, first and foremost, I love my country because as a small child growing up in Attleboro, Massachusetts, they forced us to sing 2 patriotic songs a day and say the Pledge of Allegiance.
Okay.
So, yeah. Like
the elective songs, you get to pick which 2 songs or were they? Okay.
Yeah. So it was total brainwashing. From a very early age. Okay. You get them before age 7, you get them.
Okay. All right, cool. Okay.
So I'm aware of it. I'm aware of...
You're a patriot.
This is what happened. I'm a patriot, which is an insult now.
Blue-blooded. Yeah, I mean, that's politicized. If you're a patriot, you're belong in the deplorables basket, according to some.
Do I look like a deplorable?
I don't know. I mean, you don't have a cushy office job, so you're one step away.
Yeah, no, I do. I love my country and I love the United States because we don't come from a single people. We're an idea. If you come here and you believe in the law and you believe in hard work, maybe you'll get ahead. And if you personally do not get ahead, then your children can get ahead. But what matters is you participated in something great and something new and something experimental and coming out of the Enlightenment and coming out of the idea that through critical thinking and through reasoning that we can build a better society. Well, I mean, here we are. Here we are in 2021. And so...
What do you mean? Are we on the precipice?
I don't know. I'm 50-50 that... Okay, I'm... There's the three options.
Oh, okay.
We take the road and we get better. And we learn from the past and the fact that people have written things down that we can learn from and we can improve upon ourselves, and we don't have to go the way of Salem. We don't have to go the way of the satanic panic. Okay. That's option one. It requires discipline, self-sacrifice, and everybody to stop making fun of each other. So how likely is that? Okay. Option two. It all falls apart. Oh, okay. It all just crumbles. Okay, that's a possibility. But I also think that's very optimistic. Because why should it crumble? Why should we be living in the apocalypse? Option three. We just waddle around in our own muck for hundreds and hundreds of years. Oh. Because why wouldn't we? Okay. We have all the food we need. There's no reason why we won't just wallow around in misery for many, many generations.
Oh, okay.
That's kind of where I'm going.
Okay. Barring some sort of prophet descending from the sky with a tablet or two of get your shit together and chin up, people of America, we could just wallow in...
Wallow.
What does that wallowing mean? I mean, just like gorging ourselves on low nutrient, high calorie foods of a media and nutritional sort or food sort. Okay.
Yeah, because what would interrupt it? Unless we're attacked, which if you're smart, you're not going to attack us.
Oh, okay.
We're just here. We have all these resources.
Okay. One thing that might do us in then are several different sorts of ideological viruses that we can argue about the names for these different things, but I critique them at length, and as do you, that are turning brother against brother, daughter against mother, son-in-law against mother-in-law, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those things could take hold. And among all of those things, which do you think has the best chance to tear us asunder?
Well, I'm very concerned about this recent vaxxed versus unvaxxed.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, because I see that came out of almost nowhere. And then it turned into, oh, the unvaxxed are plague rats and the vaxxed are these righteous, virtuous citizens. And that goes into the us versus them. Like on repeat, just change it around. Now, I do think the media is probably the biggest enemy to the American people right now.
Okay.
Just cool. The virus is there spreading. They're getting into people's minds. Media. And this is what, this is what we studied in sociology, and behaviorism, how to get people to react. And this is what we studied. And it was like, oh, you're not supposed to use that for evil. You're never supposed to use that for evil. But that's what money is.
Well, if good is evil and evil is good to you, I guess there's mammon. You're making the statement about mammon. This gets back to what I was going to ask about earlier. Mammon, the root of all evil thing. So you said Hollywood's there not to be ideological. It's there to make money. The media isn't there not to be ideological. It's there to make money. While I do grant that it is there to make money and not to produce, you know, beautiful, wonderful, soul-uplifting things, unless it does make money, they're particularly Hollywood's captured by a certain ideology that actually there were some documents from Lionsgate Media conglomerate or whatever that said this, you know, just did this whole like, this is how we're going to make art now, like with these identities, and we're going to weigh it, and we're going to like do all these things from this weird kind of HR, really low grade academic-y kind of filter. And they adopted that. So it's either that they adopted that because they believe in that, or they crunched the numbers and they're making a bet that this is the way to make money here on out. You know, with Disney saying, okay, we're not going to do things with white American families anymore. Just because white is just not part of our thing anymore, right? And Coca-Cola teaching people to be less white, you know? So it's either some sort of calculus or there's something else going on. But you think that money first ideology is kind of downstream from some sort of monetary selection process?
Yeah, and when I say there is ideology involved, it's just not everything. It sort of leans, it's always leaned a little progressive, even back after World War II. During World War II, they were making movies where the army was integrated. Like, the army is not integrated in World War II, but they wanted to put that out there. And I appreciate that because that's how you teach a generation the values. Yeah. So we don't need movies existing for 1,000 years that remind us of how awful we were during World War II and how we had segregated the army. So they made movies that were integrated, even though it wasn't true. It was sort of like, it was myth, it was folklore, it was these better truths that make you a better person. So I see now that Hollywood is more ideologically captured because of Twitter. Too many people are on Twitter and not going out into the real world. Oh. And I think it's a problem also that a lot of these studios are behind these huge walls. They don't see people, they don't interact with people. Mm-hmm. And they are coming from the upper classes. Mm-hmm. So they think they're doing a good, they really do think they're doing a good thing. And they just aren't familiar with the world.
Oh, okay.
So I do believe that they think that this is the future because their children are going to these private schools. It's a very, very upper echelon of people.
So insular. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Huh. But then again, what makes money? Are these huge tent poles that can be sold in, you know, China, which is a major market, and across the world. So they're not in it for art. And especially you can't have dialogue that doesn't translate well to other languages or, you know, is too poetic.
Challenging. Yeah. Poetic. Okay. Shakespeare wouldn't make anything out in Hollywood nowadays.
No, I mean, you got to dumb it down. You got to dumb it down for the popular audience. Now you have a lot of great indie films coming out.
Okay.
Great, great indie films. And that's just because the camera and the equipment is so democratized. You just need to get a good camera. Drone shots, you know, those helicopter shots used to cost thousands of thousands if you wanted to just get up there, get a stabilizer, get the right equipment. Right now, get in a drone and you can buy that drone or rent that drone. Yeah. So it is, it's different and it is complicated. But I see it's going to come back around when they realize they need to start making money or when the Chinese market kind of clamps down and says, as they've already kind of done, you can only release this many movies here per year.
Okay.
I'm sure the Indian market's going to open, but that's also very different because, like, how much are you going to charge for a ticket in India? Not to put them down or anything.
There's 1.5 billion people there. You can charge a penny a person and still make bank.
They're gonna pirate them.
Oh, okay.
And when we were in Pakistan, that's how we got movies. It was just pirated movies.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So they're going to pirate them. And so it's just like, well, how are you guys going to make the most money? Everything's going to swing back and forth.
Okay.
Now, they're not going to go way back to the way it was before, because I believe even the conservatives have gotten more progressive. They've certainly gotten less homophobic. They've gotten less racist, even though the farthest right in the country, at least I'm talking up until like 2020, we're actually much more progressive than they were 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hard to argue.
Along certain metrics, other metrics maybe not so. The you know, they say one phrase is that conservatism is progressivism with the brakes on. You know, it's just they're just a little slower moving towards certain things, but progressivism is the brakes off, and they just like when they get an idea, they get a little bugbear like we see with the gender issue. They just like, whoa, hold up, whoa, slow down. Slow down. Stop with the children. Modification. Don't need to do that.
Yeah.
Don't need to do that to be inclusive.
Well, that's going to come when the lawsuits come out.
We'll see.
That's going to become, there's only so much where you can fight reality. This is why I'm an optimist. And like, we're going to have to break a lot of eggs to get there.
Okay.
And by breaking a lot of eggs, I mean, like, there's going to be a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. whose lives are going to be ruined. But then the society is going to learn that we don't want that, and maybe we made a mistake. And I see on your channel, you have a lot of former transgender women who mm-hmm. come on and they have regret about it. And people are going to see more of that.
Yeah. So if media, I mean, there's a number of different enemies so far as I see. The bureaucracy is a pretty big one. But media is something that I can bite off and chew. And you're already in it. I'm already in it. So how do we defeat it? How do we change it? Or do we just go the Joe Rogan route and say, you know what? Let the Hollywood, let the MSM, let them do their thing. We'll do our thing. And if we make it super big, we make it super big. If not, then we'll just live humble lives. But we live by our principles, and we made people fall in love with us by sheer dent of our charm and forthrightness.
Well, this is what I talk about when I say mass hysteria, because even with people making money, you saw The Network?
I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yeah.
No. Was that The Network?
Oh, even The Network. Yeah. So at first they're all about, and they're screaming outside. Yeah. At first it's all about the money. We're gonna let this guy on. He's getting good ratings for whatever. And then, So this ideology is all about the money, whereas the people are getting worked up about it. And then toward the end, the network owner, who we only hear about on the phone, don't see him, he's now sympathetic with this man. So he's willing to take a loss monetarily to keep this idea going. And I think that's where we are right now in the network.
Oh, okay.
That some people may be willing to take a loss temporarily. But the thing about hysterias is they break. They always break. It's like a fever. And it's just like, wow. We lost our mind. Wow. We hung up a lot of witches. Oops.
Okay.
And then they just stop.
You brought up Satanic Panic. You've also brought up Salem. But there are other kinds of mass hysterias that have kind of a not as dark a twist, like I can't remember, like there's a second revival, or there's this huge Christian revival at some point in time. There's also prohibition, which is actually, interestingly enough, like an outgrowth of the women's rights movement.
It's true.
Because if they could control men's access to alcohol, they could probably receive less beatings, just to totally dumb it down. You know,
but that's true. They were drinking too much and beating their women too much. It was a major problem. So I get the need, where they felt they had a need with the first time they had the right to vote. This is what they did with it.
Take
and
it
I'm
out.
Like, ladies, I love y'all.
I think that's going to come for porn at some point if things don't go in a different direction. I could see how it happening, but that might be a whole other civil war, and we don't have to go there. That's a whole other thought experiment to see what's going to happen if that comes a national issue, as it is.
That's down on the list right now. Yeah. But it's weird. It's weird. They're trying to put weird stuff in our minds. It's very weird what's happening there.
I bring this up because there's actually a good book that I can't recall the name of. I'll try to look at it while you're answering the question. But it seems like one of the defining characteristics of America as a democratic republic or republic is that we just kind of go through these phases. We go crazy. We just go crazy. That's kind of a part of what we do. That's kind of the beauty of it. And a lot of people's lives are ruined, but a lot of bounty surfaces through that. I mean, like, if you see it over, it just happens over and over, over again in our history. What do you think, since you are a historian and a sociologist? Okay.
Well, I majored. I got to go back and get my, doctorate at some point, but I got time.
Do you perceive, so far as you can tell with your limited knowledge, that this is any different quantifiably than any other mass panics that have been particular to the United States of America?
Yeah, we have social media.
Oh.
And so, like you were saying, it's like a runaway train. And the algorithm just makes it worse. It makes it happen faster and faster.
Okay.
And so people get worked up more. And the problem is, I know this is going to sound like the most silly, idealistic thing possible.
Cool.
But if people could just put down the phone, if they could just put down the phone and go for a walk.
Oh.
And then talk to their neighbor and talk to the person, to the cashier, talk to the person making their taco, say hi, bye, how are you? The simplest things. We could avert a lot of this.
Okay. Anybody listening to this right now, you don't have to take the headphones out of your head. You just pause. Keep on listening. Keep on listening. Just pause it and recognize you're human. Then get back to the show because you're going to miss so much good content. It was called Fantasyland by Kurt Anderson. He kind of talks about this phenomena of you know, these mass hysterias, and he goes through there's a lot of really interesting things about there, about like how Disney is kind of like this weird fantasy land. They created their own kind of weird world of a pseudo America. Like, it's called like American Town or something like that, you know, but like the people who live there really believe it. It's like this religion that's been sold to them and then recreated through their imagination, and they have all these like codes that they live by, but it's like this idealistic thing. We have this idealism in us. So with the rapid ramping up of social media, you're saying one way to relieve the stress is just common, human, boring, mundane connection, and then every once in a while some witty banter when you find the right interlocutor.
Yeah, I made a video that got me put into YouTube jail.
Oh,
I think it's because what I titled it, I called it Make America Boring Again. And this make it boring. Like, your life has to be boring. You can't be excited all the time.
You got in jail for that? They gave you a strike or something?
They sent me something, DMC. And they said, they said it was offensive to children. Oh. And so they gave me a strike, but then I appealed it, and they said, okay, we were sorry.
Interesting.
But it's basically like, and this is not just the country, but how to live a life. It's just like, you can't be excited all the time. You can't have that dopamine fix all the time. Hmm. And if you're going to have that dopamine fix, it has to be for something productive. Like, you finished your exercise and you have a natural dopamine fix. You finished your chores and you have that natural dopamine fix. You finished your paper. It can't be an artificial one that comes from social media. It can't be a dopamine fix that comes from food, junk food, or TV. You have to accept that your life is going to be a little bit boring if you want to progress in life.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that got me put in YouTube jail.
Weird. That was kind of a Petersonian take. I don't know if you know of this fellow up in Canada called Jordan Peterson. He took the internet by storm a couple years ago. He's since not as big, but culturally speaking, but... he's kind of like back to basics, mundanity. But is that quantifiably different, this mundane life, where your dopamine is restricted to actual real world or semi-real world cultural events, physical events? Is that different? How is that different than wallowing in the muck, our third option of your three-point future plan for America?
Well, wallowing in the muck is the opposite of that. We stay with our dopamine fixes that don't get us anywhere. The highways continue to fall into disrepair. We never make the train systems that we need. We're just so busy on our phone fighting with somebody in Idaho over something that we're going to get
Nancy
over
Pelosi
in a
said,
month
yeah.
anyway. Yeah. Yeah, like, this is wallowing in the muck, where we can't get it to ourselves to look at ourselves in the mirror and say, this is how I am, and these are the improvements I need to make to make my life better, and this is the work I need to do to make my community better.
Okay.
Work. People don't want to do the work. The man hours, the physical labor that is required to improve themselves and improve their community. It's work. It's not going to be glamorous.
We call that prostate owner hours, not man hours anymore. Just to let you know, you're kind of falling behind.
I stayed inside the whole day, and I missed all this new vocabulary. I can't believe it.
Okay, well, you say all that, but you're just a measly comedian. All you do is pump out virtual content. So how are you helping America? How are you lifting up your neighbor by the work that you do? Or how would you ideally hope that that does something better than dope?
Well, I feel my videos are helpful. I feel I don't really have many videos or any videos that I look back at and say, well, that didn't help anybody. Because I do put the effort in to do the research and to have my resources on the page so that you can click and learn about it. So anybody who wanted to learn, even if what I've given them isn't enough, they can stop and then take that asset and look at the article, and then they can go from there.
Okay.
Besides that,
So are you kind of like a professoress or a professor, like or you're doing journalism then, basically?
I'm doing journalism. I wanted to be a writer, and so I wrote this thing called Gurukula, and I illustrated it. And it was like, I thought this was going to be like my life's work, because it was basically making fun of the spiritualism in Los Angeles. And it was these two girls who were basically based on me and my best friend, who are trying to find spiritualism, and all we do is make these poor people's lives worse. And we just cause problems. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I'm going to make this channel, and then I'm going to read Gurukula to the people. But in order to write a work of satire that's any good, you have to know about the world, because you have to be making fun of the world. Mm-hmm. So you have to do the research. Mm-hmm. You have to be like, well, I can't just make fun of someone from what I've seen on Twitter. I have to go through and figure out, first off, what do they believe? Because if you make some fun of someone's belief and you don't understand their belief thoroughly, well, what are you doing? Mm. I mean, you're not helping anyone. You've just
you're playing to the haters of that, who have assumptions that you could just as well mine for parody yourself if you looked into them.
Yeah. So that's what I started off. I was like, you know, through satire, I can make people see that they're being silly. And we also do this guy. We do this thing. We made a fake guru on YouTube to respond to all of these like wellness gurus. And so we got a comedian, and his page is called Direct Currents. And he's a fake guru, and he's a sociopath. And he's trying to sleep with his followers and make more money, which is what they were doing. So we're like, okay, so the algorithm is going to pop this guy up after they've watched 10 videos of real gurus, and they're going to be like, oh, I'm stupid, huh? And then that would be the, okay, go outside and go for a walk. You'll be fine. Okay. Just go for a walk. He's just being goofy.
Okay.
So I was like, oh, we can do this through comedy. And then, of course, I got less ambitious because, I mean, it's not working. Life has become so comedic that, like, what are you supposed to do through comedy?
Okay, yeah, okay.
How are you supposed to help through comedy if the whole world is absurd?
Okay.
So now I'm here just screaming into the void. Huh. Kind
you
of screaming
scream.
Into the void.
You don't scream. It's very well measured. You're at least not hoarse by the end of filming, it doesn't seem like.
No, I love it. And I love my followers, and I love talking to them. I talk to them in the comments. They have great things to say, great things to add. And, you know, I'm just interacting. I just feel I'm part of a community. And I think being part of a community and being an honest player in a community, maybe it's not going to save the world, but if more people were honest players, then if enough were honest players, that might.
There is a slight contradiction between having a community of your housing complex or apartment building and having a parasocial relationship with strangers on the internet. But you still think that there's value there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because just because it's on the internet, especially over this past year where a lot of people were only on the internet for whatever reason, they were afraid to leave their house, or they were not allowed to go to work, or for whatever reason, they're on the internet, and I speak to them, and you know, I genuinely feel like I want to help them. If anyone is ever comments something that, oh, I'm in trouble, I need this, da da da, I'm glad to help them. In fact, I've started this Sydney Challenge with people I've never met before, and she's an exercise guru, and I'm like, so all these people I've never met before. This is through another webpage I'm on. I'm like, if you guys want to get on this 90-day fitness challenge with me, get on. I'm glad to have you on. And we'll do it together. And we'll put out, you know, every day that we do it. And I'm just hoping that if even like a few people are like, well, I have control over my life to a certain degree. I at least have control over my health. Mm-hmm. And they spread that to some people. Most people don't actually follow up. That's the thing. Yeah. Most people are not willing to put in the work, even for their health. And that's okay. But I'm willing to look stupid being the only one putting anything on this spreadsheet, just so that they know, like, hey, it's cool. I'm there for you. Get back on when you can.
Mm-hmm. You're doing the work. You're doing the work.
Yeah.
Which brings me back to a point that you said earlier about if you don't know the world, you can't satirize it. There was this Sorry to bring up tweets. I know how much you hate them. There's this one guy who's very active on Twitter. He's been on my channel a couple times. Brilliant man, Andrew Doyle. He's got this parody account called Titania McGrath or Titania or whatever.
Tatiana, or something like that. Yeah.
British will correct me endlessly with that name, but it doesn't matter because she's fake. And anyway, so this other guy that I know, actually in real life, because he's in Portland, Peter Boghossian, who's this professor, he's working at Portland State University, and he did this kind of hoax to show that there's these huge apparati within the academic institution that produce crap. And so mm-hmm. him and James Lindsay and Helen Pluckrose, great people, all, they got together. They made these hoax papers that just do some crazy things. One notable thing that's easy to describe besides the dildo one is that they basically took a passage from Mein Kampf and just put feminist jargon in there. But it's the same exact thing, you know, and they got it in this academic journal, right? And then they kind of like pulled down the pants on these academics. And Peter was ran out of over time. He was put on pressure more and more, and he finally quit the university. But there was this video that he made about wokeness. And he based his video, these points, on Andrew Doyle's parody of wokeness, called Woke by Titania McGrath. And then a commenter, sorry, this is a really long way to get to a very simple point. A commenter said, it's a funny book, but you can't trust that as a source. That's not a valid source. I'm like, well, you know, actually, satire, I phrased it better, but it was along the lines of what you're trying to point out, is that satire that works is actually invalidating something by submitting it to a higher validation. So it's validation in relief, or a cameo validation, by putting down whatever this thing that they're critiquing that they call woke in that context. They're actually submitting woke to, probably they would call it, liberal values, right? They're saying actually it's a poor imitation, and therefore it's really funny, because if you turn up the dials, it's actually really silly and scary even. As my channel attests, and some of the other things attest to. So in your, you say you're lazy. I don't think you're lazy. You're working the pavement. You're working the stuff. But you kind of intimated that you weren't ready to do serious satire because you're still in a learning phase. Is that what's going on? It's kind of like you're playing a pickup game with reality. Like, okay, here's something that interests me. I'm going to look into it, and something funny's probably going to happen. And then you're going to go into the next thing. But you're in a engagement with.
I don't know what serious satire would be right now. Because right now, comedy's captured. And there is the fight with Dave Chappelle to uncapture it. And I am firmly behind Dave Chappelle because we need to break through these walls. But comedy, you see the satire. We saw satire.
Hannah Gatsby versus Dave Chappelle. Those are kind of the two main pillars of these two kind of warring factions. Would that be fair if you know Gatsby?
Yeah, I've heard of Gatsby. I haven't watched any of her stand-up specials, so I can't say if she's any good or not. I don't know.
So
if
how
she,
is
she's
comedy capture? She's a particular vein of that. Like, is it?
I'm thinking more of The Daily Show. I'm thinking more of Stephen Colbert and these people who used to be satirists before Trump got into office that took an ideological position against Trump, a hard one. That includes Jim Jefferies as well.
Who's Jefferies? Where is he?
Jefferies is the Australian guy.
Oh, okay.
I used to be a huge, huge fan of Jim Jefferies. And once they took that position, that's like, I'm against this person, and so I'm going to do whatever to bring him down. I'm like, you have to say the truth. Just like journalists, people go to comedians for the truth. Whatever that might be, however hard that might be to hear. Like, you have to be truthful. You can't have a side. And if you can say, oh, I come from, you know, rural Kentucky, and this is how I grew up, and so this is how I see the world. But then you make fun of yourself a little by saying, well, this, my perspective is influenced by this, and therefore this is how I think. But you still make fun of yourself, and you make fun of that perspective. Mm-hmm. So
and it was all aimed outward. With the coming of Trump, they were allowed, it formed a blind spot wherein nothing could criticize them, or they weren't allowed to criticize the other side. And then it kind of just goes on from there.
So it goes on from there.
COVID doing a weird stage show with vaccinated things, the really hokey music.
where are we? What are we doing right now where people are coming at the unvaxxed? And I swear, a year ago, you played clips of it was the opposite.
Yeah.
With, I don't trust Trump's vaccine. Yeah. I don't trust what is going on. Are you going to take it? I did the Nicki Minaj versus the world and actually played clips from them from a year ago of what they said, of the talking points in the mainstream press.
Mm.
And then like goldfish, we have no memories this country. It switched and everybody forgot. This is where we are. I think reality is so funny. And so basically, I was like, well, there's no point for me, to me doing satire, because I am going to put Garukula out. I'm going to, but I've kind of got myself in this position, especially my channel, where I cover real world things and I cover them accurately, but I also make jokes. And I don't think you can watch any of my videos and say, oh, you're wrong about that. You could say that's in poor taste to make that joke.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, these are facts. It's just reality has gotten so absurd that I'm like, well, we got to put satire aside for a while and fix the glaring problem we have with our country right now. Glaring. It's glaring.
You dropped a trigger word for me. Actually, it's a phrase. I hear this a lot, and I'm a stickler for language. I'm somewhat of a linguistic anthropope myself. And it's talking points. You know, people say, you're just repeating these right-wing talking points. I came up with a tweet finally to kind of like put everybody in their place that, quote, that's a right-wing talking point, end quote, is a left-wing talking point, end quote, centrist talking point, right? So how do we avoid having talking points? I mean, I get accused of that, which it's kind of a straw man thing, and I know that, but I just want people to, somebody somewhere out there might rethink how they're using talking point as a rhetorical kind of box to put somebody else's thing in. Because I do jokes. I say something that's funny. You know, I found a picture or like this video of Joe Biden pounding the podium and saying, fewer! Fewer, you know, he's talking about like how there's less democracies now than before. Fewer, and he's so mad, you know, and I'm like, well, you know, it's not a good look, Joe, to pound a podium saying the word fewer. And then, you know, come after me. I'm making a joke and they're like, you're doing like some sort of talking point, right wing talking point, anti-vax talking point. What's a talking point? What's a talking point? And how do we not make them? How do you know that you're not making them?
I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with talking points. I think the problem with talking points or the bullet points that you use is that people will say something on the other side. Let's say, I call them red team, blue team.
Okay.
So someone will say something on the other side, and then rather than refuting what they have said, you'll just twist what they've said around to get back to a talking point that you know how to refute.
Okay.
So you're putting words in their mouths and you're moving it around. There's no problem with talking points because these are arguments. This is just rhetoric. If you say that's a talking point, well, so what?
Yeah.
Is it wrong or is it right?
Yeah. Okay.
I don't care if it's a talk. I don't care what you call it.
Okay.
If you've made an argument that makes sense and is logical, you have to refute that on its face. It doesn't matter if it's a right-wing talking point or left-wing talking point.
Yeah. Okay. So you're talking about a script that people bend everything to, not just reality, but to the conversation at hand. So it's an inability to play with these ideas, to be challenged in your ideas. And to argue thoroughly your ideas, or even pretend that you don't believe those ideas, and are you the counter? I don't think it's a factual. I keep on wanting to say counterfactual, but I know I don't know what it means, so I'm abstaining from that word. But you know, like the Millsian, though he who cannot defend his own point doesn't have it, or something like that. But he who can't argue for the other person's point can't be sure that they aren't, they can actually refute it. If they can't actually like completely embody it and refute for it, steel man it, then you can't say that you totally disregard it because you haven't actually tried on those particular shoes.
And yeah. And you know what? Some of the talking points from both sides, it's like, oh yeah, you're right. You gotta be able to concede. Oh, you're right on that point. And that's not the whole thing. I mean, that's why it's not going to be, oh, left team wins or red team wins or blue team wins. It's going to be like, well, we're going to have to compromise.
Okay.
Because they're going to be right on some things this other team is going to be right on some things. So who's right? And then what can we, how can we make this work with our values? Because reality does change. The only things about reality that don't really change are like the laws of nature, the laws of physics. But our social reality can change and it can adapt. And we've seen it happen over our lifetime. Mm-hmm. So how do we make this work? Think about it like an engineer. Don't necessarily think about it like, you know, that like a tribalist. Because the tribalism is not working. And when a person makes a good point, you got to say, oh, that's a good point. It doesn't win the entire argument, but you made a good point.
Mm-hmm. Was there a moment in your reckless youth where you were extremely tribal, where you were one of those blue-haired individuals or a red-haired individual or whatever, maybe a trad activist, I don't know, whatever. Were you ever like completely ideologically possessed where you knew all the answers and you're just going to go through it? What you were promoting then? What was your issue and how did you get out of that?
Like I said, I grew up around Brown University.
Okay.
I grew up in Brown University. I'm obviously...
Are they big into abortion there? What's their big thing?
Oh, they love abortion.
Okay, that's
the thing. Give them away like candies. No, they're very left-wing. It's a very left-wing place. I come from a very left-wing place. In university, there is something to be said for left-wing values being encouraged. You know, everybody has to take certain classes, and there are certain lines that you have to hold. Also, when I was younger, well, it was different because we were coming out of, like I was talking about with after 9/11, that chaos was the red team lost its mind. After 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a reaction to that. This is the evangelicals saying that Bush is like the second coming or, you know, it's coming from God. So the reaction to that, I believe, is what kind of made the woke, because it was like, okay, we have an existential threat, which is the red team is taking over government. Mm-hmm. They're launching wars all over the world. They're a threat. And so what is the reaction to that? It's the militant atheism that is the, as far as the identity politics, you know, we have to value people of different identities. So that was the reaction to that. And so, yeah, I used to be big into Bernie Sanders, and I still love Bernie Sanders because I find him to be an honest man.
Yeah.
But being honest did not work out for Bernie Sanders. And it's just like, you have to be honest and you have to take the hit being honest and you got to be like, okay, I lost, but at least I can hold my head high. And so I still very much respect Bernie Sanders and what he tried to do. And I think that if he had gotten elected president, or at least he had been running in 2016, we would have had a shot. It would have been populism versus populism from one versus the other. And we could have really decided, but that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to marry these two wings of the blue team, the progressives, the far left progressives, with corporate Democrats.
Yeah.
Like, I am not a corporate Democrat.
Okay.
I'm not going to go along with this. If Apple is trying to sell me an ideology, I'm suspicious off the bat. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you want? No. Especially pharma, all these people. I grew up as a hippie. That's different. That is not corporate Democrat at all. So I believe it started to happen around 2015 where the woke, quote unquote, and I say this before that, the woke used to be a reaction to what was going on post 9/11. It used to be about, we have to acknowledge that there are injustices in the justice system. Mm-hmm. And it became something very strange, just strange. Illogical, and it decided that reality didn't exist.
And is that where they left you? Like, what were the first signs that things were getting to a place where you can't be invested in this kind of left-ish sphere? Like, where the woke thing kind of rose up? And were you along for the ride up to a certain point, or was there just something kind of odd about it?
I fell out with a lot of my friends on Facebook, and I had to get off Facebook because I was getting into too many fights. And I can't get into fights on Facebook, and I can't ruin family relationships. So I just deleted my Facebook account. But I fell out with a lot of my friends and people who I thought were you know, on the same page over Mattress Girl.
Oh.
Do you remember Mattress Girl?
Yeah. That's a cool hill to die on. I would have never
took like,
that for...
Really? Because it didn't make any sense. As soon as that the defendant, is he now the plaintiff because he's suing? Yeah. As soon as that guy screwed. Came out, yeah, he said, I got the receipts. And he had the receipts.
Yeah.
He got the receipts. That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, yes. He said, she said, okay, we don't know. Let's see where this goes. Let's see where the investigation goes. Okay. But when he came out with the receipts, he's got the receipts. What are we going to say?
Hmm. And why were people, so far as you know, that you were arguing with, denying that narrative that they had adopted? What was the cognitive dissonance that wasn't, like, actually getting to a place where they couldn't see, like, a value was being trod under underfoot for the sake of justice, I guess?
Well, one person said that in order for her feminism to be real, she had to believe Mattress Girl, that somehow Mattress Girl represented feminism. Which I was like, what? You can't hold a belief that is contrary to proven reality. Now, I get it if you have a religion. If you are like, yo, I know there's no evidence for this, you know, sky fairy, but I believe in the sky fairy, and that's just the way it is. I won't argue with you about the sky fairy. Don't try to put it in government. That's what Bush did, and that's a problem. That was a problem, and I feel we were right to push back on whatever that was, the attempted evangelical takeover, the neocons or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're telling me that I don't care what the truth is, we got to scapegoat this guy. We got to hang him up, even if we can prove that he was, or to the best of the evidence that we have. The only actual evidence that we have says that this guy was not in the wrong. Whether he was in the right or not, he was not in the wrong. And so...
It was premarital sex, so they're all going to hell, like, at the end of the day, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's college, so... But he didn't, I was just like, yo, I had to pose, I had like, yo, he didn't rape her. And then I had people, first off, I got into a lot of arguments. Then I had people messaging me who are on that side. And they're like, thank you for saying that. I couldn't say it, but you know, what you said made a lot of sense. And I was like, what are you talking? I also moved away from home by this point. So I was away from Rhode Island.
Okay.
I was in Los Angeles. So I was sort of just observing the country as it was, and I didn't realize that they were in such an environment where they couldn't say what they thought to be true, what they knew to be true. They couldn't even say it safely. And so that was the first time where I was like, uh-oh, things are going mad.
And so you did the right thing and deleted Facebook instead of torching every single intimate relationship in your life, but maybe you did sacrifice
a few, little bit. I did a few torching.
Yeah.
A little bit of that. Yeah. Which is, yeah.
So fast forward to 2021. We're almost on 2022. Who knows what the future holds? You're pumping out these videos. What do you have a production schedule? I could see you doing like one or two a week planned, but how often do you produce?
I try to do one a week.
Yeah, okay.
I do. They do take quite a lot of time. And this one coming up.
You can tell.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. This one coming up is it's going to be like 45 minutes to an hour. It's about Alex Jones. It's a revisit of my Alex Jones.
Fun.
Oh, yeah. He's so entertaining.
He's.
And he might be the Antichrist. What? He might actually be the Antichrist, according to his own lore.
Yeah. Oh, him?
Okay. He went through his school screaming when he was younger that he is the spawn of Satan. Like, there was a report about it and everything. So I try to do once a week, unless it's like this, where it's like, this is so much work. Then it's like maybe once every 2 weeks. But sometimes there's two a week, depending on the length.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if I can get an interview in, I'll have an expert and we'll talk about various things. I like to... As I say, I don't have a doctorate degree, so I bring people who either have doctorate degrees or have been working for years in that respected area on, and I ask them, I grill them, and then I can say, well, I have an expert.
Yeah. And you've been doing, how long have you been doing these shows then?
Just almost 1 year. 10.
So 1 year. So with 1 year of experience and 50 some odd, more or less, episodes under your belt, what is something that you think has not been spoken about that needs to be spoken about more? If you're terribly plugged into the other commentating community.
Oh, okay. So this is, I kind of addressed this in the Alex Jones coming up. And you addressed this with the anti-woke. It's that we have two competing sides, and one's going to be a reaction to the other. So we're going to go from the evangelicals under Bush to the woke to whatever is coming up next. And I see a real problem with what's coming up next because I'm around youths a lot, and I see a lot of them
like
are more homeschooled.
Like those pack animals?
Young people, like children.
Youths. That was is that Rhode Island slang? Youths.
Youths.
Yeah, whatever. Youths. I'm just putting
And I'm around these children, and I'm like, okay, you can't, especially if they're homeschooled. A lot of these parents have taken their kid out of school to just say, I'm not putting you in these schools. And they say things to me. At first, I'm like, okay, well, that's interesting. But then you see their behavior, and I'm like, oh, okay. What we have is a reaction to woke now with some of them.
Okay.
With some of them. And so the ones who are like 12 now, I have no idea how they're going to grow up.
All right.
Because you have the ones that are in school, and they're being told the narrative. And then you have the many who are being homeschooled or in private schools who have a different narrative. And I just don't know how this is going to look in 10 years.
Yeah. Well, do you think that it's going to be a reaction like the hippies were to the 50s or the Jesus freaks were to the hippies or the punks were to whatever the punks were, the world? And then my era, the emos, we just hated existence itself. Like we got big. So what's the reaction going to be? Do you figure the wokeness, you don't know what kind of cultural forms it's going to take. Is it going to be hardline trad living? Is it going to be
wives make me sad.
Really?
I mean, I get it.
They're so pretty with all that pie and the aprons and stuff. Come on.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything wrong with being domestic. People will tell you I was very well trained in being domestic as a child. I still am fairly domestic. I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but that's not like your identity.
Identity, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Your identity can't be like, oh, I'm a good wife because I don't know. Maybe there's going to be more traditional living. I am worried that there seems to be like competing apocalypse cults out right now. And it's like, one thing, so the world's going to end from climate change in 12 years. Or, sorry, 9 years.
Yeah. Keeps on getting shorter. Well, I guess that's time for you, though.
Yeah. So that one side thinks the world's going to end from climate change. And the other side thinks that we're going through revelations.
Oh, okay.
They think we're literally going through the revelations period and that the end is coming and that this the vaccine is the mark of the beast. And I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. Everyone need to calm down a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Biblical evil. I don't like any of these apocalypse things.
Oh, really?
I don't like, yeah. Okay. It's fun. It's fun lore. It's so much. I want to watch movies about it. But when I start seeing people online talking about this is biblical evil, we got to get our guns, we got to do this. And that's not to say I'm not getting my guns. But nevertheless, like, everybody need to chill right now.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I recommend Jonathan Peugeot's channel. He channels the symbolic understanding of things, and he's got a lot to say about everything that you said about the cults and all that language stuff. He has a very fascinating and grounding way of translating the biblical symbolism to reality to show kind of like just the underlying archetypal things that are going on. Which doesn't, it's a nice little, that whole archetypal Jungian thing is a great kind of way to thread fantasy and reality and say, okay, these things aren't true, but they're not untrue. Just like the whole question, the perennial question, would we be better off with a religion, or is some aspects of the wokeness kind of just a kind of regurgitated religion, kind of sifted through academia and media and stuff. Like, you know, what is religion? What is that pattern? And how can we get it without some sort of story, without some sort of fairy tale?
Well, they have a story. The woke has a story, and that's, you know, we overcame the evil system. And, you know, we're a group, and together as a group, we're stronger and so forth and so on. The problem is, you know, the problem is what they're going through, which a lot of religions go through, is like exiling heretics and exiling heretics and exiling heretics. And so what do you got left? Mm-hmm. I mean,
I have a documentary, if you want to know who rises to the top of that.
What's it called?
It's called The Complete Evergreen Story. It's what I'm known for.
Okay.
Yeah. If you're feeling a little too optimistic about humanity, this will tone your hopeless optimism down. Inject a little hopeful skepticism. We've gone on. I've taken up a lot of your time, and you're a very busy bee. Unless you identify as an aunt or an ant, or some sort of collective insect. Your channel is excellent, and you're a great guest. You're keen, a lot of insight. Maybe we could connect at another time and have another show together. Stuff like that.
I would love that.
So what are we going to plug? You don't have a Substack because you don't write right now, but you have a YouTube channel.
I have a YouTube channel,
and it's Maya.
Maya
Muses. Okay.
And I spell my name M-A-Y-E, Muses. And I put a video out once a week.
Do you have like a podcast as well?
It's all on YouTube. And also on Odyssey. Are you on Odyssey?
Yeah, I'm on Odyssey.
Okay.
Benjamin E. Boyce on Odyssey. And you have your videos and stuff. Are you doing other programming? Are you producing other indie films or comedy specials and stuff off your own channel? Or is your channel your main thing right now?
Oh, yeah. I'm on this YouTube show called Wording is Harder.
What is
comedians.
Harder?
Wording is Harder with Tahir Moore. And basically, he can't speak, or he says he's got a fat tongue. He's a fantastic comedian.
Okay.
His stand-up is top-notch.
Okay.
And basically, he is one of the contestants, and then another contestant comes on, and I have to make these questions for them. They pronounce words. They tell me, where did the word come from? What's the etymology? There's this new question, is spot the fake, where I'll put in one fake English word, but three words that look like they could be fake English words, and then they have to find which word is the fake word, because they're always saying English is stupid.
Yeah.
And so I kind of play the I'm so smart teacher. So I play a teacher, I've got glasses, and that's a character I play, and we bring all these comedians in, and they're just like, you just want to make us look dumb, huh? And I'm like, no, this is a role. This isn't real. It's just a joke. It's just fun. And it's a lot of fun, because we get to really explore the English language and learn more about it. And it's kind of a love fest with the English language.
Mm. Wow. Sounds right up my alley. I'll have to check that out. It's called Wording is Harder. Harder, not fun. Harder.
It used to be Wording is Hard, but then we switched up the format to make it more than pronunciation. And now it's all about English, and it's so much fun, but it's very R-rated. They're constantly cursing and talking about sex and all these great things, and they're hilarious. And my thing is, don't laugh. Mm-hmm. They always try to make me laugh, and I'm just like, do not laugh.
Okay.
You do not find these people funny. I don't care if they're professional comedians.
Do you think they're ridiculous. Do they break you? Are they able to break you often?
Not often.
Okay.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And that's on Tahir Moore's YouTube page.
Okay. Well, I'll link your show and that show in the description. Thank you so much for joining me on a like complete pickup date. I just like emailed you 2 days ago, and you're like, yeah, let's do it. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Benjamin Boyce. I'm a big fan.
Well, thank you. That's wonderful to hear. Congratulations for reaching the end of the discussion. If you enjoyed it, do be sure to leave a review or a comment or a thumbs up or whatever you need to do to show that glorious algorithm that this is some good stuff. And do be sure to go and check that back catalog, as it is brimming full of fantastic conversations. Links to provide monetary support are down there in the description as well. Have a good night.